Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Ann Ball, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
China is preparing to become the first country to launch its own digital currency. China's central bank has released few details of its digital currency electronic payment project. Work on the project began 5 years ago. Some observers say the DCEP shows both financial innovation and the government's desire to increase control over the movement of money. China's digital currency has similarities to Facebook's proposed digital currency, Libra, and existing cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin. Like those forms of payment, the Chinese currency will be stored in a digital wallet. What is somewhat different is that China's central bank will be able to follow where the money is going and even supervise trading. Observers say the goal of the project is for China to protect its economy at a time when newer payment systems could permit illegal money flows. Ke Yu Jin is a professor at the London School of Economics. She said, "There's a consensus around the world among central bank governors and governments at large that they want to have control of money and money supply." She added that the strong desire for control is probably more unique to China than anything else. In September, China's central bank chief, Yi Gang, said there was no timeline for launching the digital currency and that more work needed to be done. The Reuters news agency reports that the People's Bank of China has sought legal rights to more than 50 inventions related to the digital currency. Chinese officials have not hidden their disapproval of Facebook's Libra. They have called it a threat to the sovereignty of China and other developing economies. China claims that digital currencies should only be provided by governments or central banks. Mu Changchun is the head of the Chinese Central Bank's Digital Currency Research Center. He has suggested that the new currency should be made available through commercial banks, just as physical money is. The digital currency will follow models similar to systems such as Apple Pay and the Chinese payment system Alipay. These require a commercial bank to put money into a digital wallet that can be downloaded onto a smartphone. Unlike physical money, however, a tracking system could follow the digital currency's movements from one person to another. Mu said the digital currency would strike a balance between anonymous payments and classified supervision. He said the goal is to prevent illegal financial activities, with officials able to watch for such activity by studying huge amounts of information. Once we analyze these transactions, use big data and data mining technology, and conduct identity comparisons, we will be able to find the culprits, he said. So far, there has been limited public reaction in China, a country already used to weak privacy protections and government control. But people on social media sites, such as Weibo, have expressed a mix of feelings. Some say a digital currency could prevent corruption, but others are concerned. One user asked, "What will happen to my freedom to build wealth, my secrets, and safety?" I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Astronauts on the International Space Station will soon test a new oven for making chocolate chip cookies. A spaceship carrying the cooking equipment and other supplies was launched Saturday from the Wallops Flight Facility in the United States. The shipment, weighing 3,700 kilograms, reached the space station on Monday. The goal is to explore the possibility of making freshly baked cookies for space travelers. American company NanoRacks designed and built the oven and helped with organizing the flight to the space station. Hilton DoubleTree Hotels supplied the cookie dough the astronauts will use. In the past, space station crews have created their own pizzas using a thin, flat piece of bread known as flatbread. Astronauts have tried other creative ways to make food, such as creating salads from vegetables grown in the space station. Results have been mixed. The cookie baking will be a slow process. The oven can heat just one cookie at a time. It could be weeks before the astronauts have time to try out the oven. 5 unbaked cookies have been in a space station freezer for several weeks. Each is in its own individual clear bag made out of silicone. The oven can heat foods to temperatures as high as 177 degrees Celsius. That is twice the temperature of the U.S. and Russian food warmers on the space station. The oven uses electric heating elements. Mary Murphy is with NanoRacks. Murphy said, she expects a baking time of 15 to 20 minutes for each cookie when the oven is heated to about 163 degrees Celsius. She added that the smell of baking cookies should fill the space station each time a cookie comes out of the oven. The Associated Press reported her comments. The oven's first use will be the real test. Without the force of gravity, the astronauts do not know exactly how the cookie will look. 3 of the space-baked cookies are to be returned to Earth for testing. Baking doesn't always go according to plan, even on the ground, said Murphy. The American space agency NASA has agreements with two companies, Northrop Grumman and SpaceX, to keep the space station supplied. The recent launch is Northrop Grumman's 12th successful flight of its Cygnus rocket since 2013.
A new report shows that most American 4th and 8th graders did not do well on math and reading tests. The latest so-called Nation's Report Card was released last week. There were some exceptions. Students in Washington, D.C. made important gains in both reading and math this year, according to the National Assessment of Education Progress. Students in the state of Mississippi also made major improvements compared to earlier reports. Nationally, however, America's eighth graders are falling behind in math and reading. And math scores among fourth graders also decreased. A little more than one-third of eighth graders are proficient in reading and math. Proficient means to be skilled at doing something. About a third of fourth graders are proficient readers. Over 40% are considered proficient in math.
U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos said the overall national results show a student achievement crisis. She also said the problem cannot be fixed by giving more money to public schools. Instead, she called for expanded school choice. This includes her proposals for school vouchers and greater dependence on privately run charter schools. DeVos said last week that American children continue to fall behind students of the same grade in other countries. But, she said, with education freedom, American students can compete. Scott Sargrad is with the Center for American Progress. He writes about education at the kindergarten through 12th grade levels, or K through 12. Writing on Forbes.com, he said DeVos is wrong and that money matters in education. He said the falling scores are because of lower spending on education following the Great Recession of 2008. In Washington, D.C., public school leader Louis Farabee said the improved scores happened for a number of reasons. They include the start of free schooling for all 3- and 4-year-olds living in D.C. The program began in 2008. He also credited Washington's effort to increase teacher pay. He says better pay permits D.C. schools to be competitive at a time when there's a nationwide shortage of good teachers. For the first time in the test's history, Mississippi fourth graders scored above the national average in math. In reading, they scored equal to the national average. The state remained behind national averages in eighth grade, but continued to improve in math and stayed about the same in reading.
Carrie Wright is Mississippi's state superintendent of education. She said the southern state has been improving early reading education and has been working to help teachers improve math instruction. America's big city public schools educate more poor students as well as English language learners. In general, these schools also saw some good news. Big city schools still performed below the nation as a whole, but the difference was less than before. I'm Ann Ball.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. 1852 was a presidential election year in the United States. The Democratic Party held its nominating convention in Baltimore, Maryland. The meeting opened in June of 1852. Delegates agreed that a man must win two-thirds of the convention's votes to be the Democratic candidate. On the first ballot, no one received two-thirds of the vote, so the voting continued. Finally, on the 47th ballot, support began to increase for someone considered an unlikely candidate. His name was Franklin Pierce. Pierce was from the northeastern state of New Hampshire. He was a lawyer and former state lawmaker. He also had served in the United States Senate and House of Representatives. He became an officer in the Army during the U.S. War with Mexico. On the 49th ballot, Pierce won the Democratic nomination. He would be the party's candidate for president.
Pierce was a passionately loyal adherent of the Democratic Party and of its principles of negative governance domestically and spread eagle expansionism in foreign affairs.
Historian Michael Holt wrote a book about Franklin Pierce. Mr. Holt describes Pierce as someone who was like most Democrats at the time. In other words, he did not think the federal government should intervene much in efforts to help build up and develop the nation. But he wanted the United States to play a big and powerful role internationally. Naturally, Democrats did not agree on every policy issue. In 1852, the party was sharply divided on whether the government should or could permit slavery to continue in the United States. But Democrats decided to limit their fighting with each other during the election campaign, and they all agreed to support Pierce. The Whig Party held its presidential nominating convention in Baltimore 2 weeks after the Democrats met. The same thing that happened at the Democratic convention now happened at the Whig convention. Delegates voted over and over again, but no man got enough votes to win. It took 53 ballots before one of the men, General Winfield Scott, won the nomination. On election day, Pierce won a crushing victory. The Democrats won not only the presidency, but also strong majorities in Congress. The Democrats' victory was so great that many people thought the Whig Party was finished. In fact, many Whigs themselves hoped their party was destroyed. Like the Democrats, Whigs disagreed with each other about slavery. Northern Whigs wanted to form a new anti-slavery party, and Southern Whigs wanted to form a party that would better represent their interests. The Whigs lost badly in the 1852 elections because, unlike the Democrats, they were not able to bridge the differences between their Northern and Southern members. Franklin Pierce was 48 years old when he took office. He was the youngest man yet to be elected president. He was charming and made friends easily, but those who knew Pierce best worried about him. They knew that under all his friendly charm, he was a weak man. They feared the duties and problems of the presidency would be too great for him to deal with. Pierce also faced a difficult situation in his personal life. Two of his children had died when they were babies. A third child was killed in a train accident shortly before Pierce moved to the White House. In addition, his wife, Jane, did not like living in Washington, D.C. She did not support her husband's campaign for presidency. Years earlier, she had urged him to resign from the Senate and return to New Hampshire. She did not want to go back to Washington. When her husband was elected, she agreed to live there, but she rarely saw anyone. One of her close friends took her place at public events. Historian Michael Holt says Franklin Pierce's main goal as president was to keep his party united. One way to maintain party unity was to adopt popular Democratic policies. He promised strong support for expanding the territory of the United States. He also promised a strong foreign policy. During his term in office, Pierce successfully negotiated with Britain to gain American fishing rights along the coast of Canada. He also supported diplomatic and trade talks with Japan. However, he was unsuccessful in an attempt to buy Cuba from Spain. National issues presented President Pierce with a more difficult problem. Now that the election was over, some Democrats felt it was time once again to raise the issue of slavery. The Compromise of 1850 had settled the question of slavery only in the Western territories. But anti-slavery activists said the compromise should have done more to end slavery throughout the country. And pro-slavery activists said the agreement did not protect slave owners' rights. They did not want the federal government to intervene in slavery anywhere. As president in 1853, Pierce had to choose between the competing sides. He could support the Compromise of 1850 and say the dispute over slavery was settled. Or Pierce could try to make peace with both anti- and pro-slavery extremists. Giving the extremists jobs in his administration would be the easy way to satisfy their demands. And that was the policy Pierce chose.
Contemporaries at the time predicted that this attempt to share the plums would wreck the party, and it did.
Historian Michael Holt says Pierce sought to include men from competing sides of the Democratic Party in his cabinet. Pierce named William Marcy of New York as Secretary of State. Marcy wanted to limit the spread of slavery and keep the Union together. Jefferson Davis of Mississippi was named Secretary of War. Davis, more than any other man, represented Southern slave owners. He threatened to take the South out of the Union if the government set any limits on slavery. Caleb Cushing of Massachusetts was named Attorney General. Although a Northerner, Cushing was a friend of many Southerners. He was a very able man, but his loyalties were not clear. James Buchanan of Pennsylvania was named Minister to Britain. All these men had strong ideas about the future of the United States. President Pierce found it difficult to control them. One senator even said the administration should not have been called the Pierce administration because Pierce did not lead it. He said it was an administration of enemies of the Union who used the president's name and power for their own purposes. As president, Franklin Pierce faced another difficult question. Where should the United States build its new railroads? The country had expanded, and white settlers were moving west. Many were hungry for good transportation. They wanted railroads that reached across the continent from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean. Engineers decided that four new rail lines would be possible. They could cross the southern, central, or northern parts of the United States. Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas, a Democrat, proposed that three of the lines be built. He said the government could give land to the railroad companies. The companies could then sell the land to get the money they needed to build the lines. A Senate committee discussed the issue. Its members proposed that only one railroad line be built. But which one? Many congressmen believed a southern line would be best. There would be little snow in winter, and the railroad would cross lands that were already organized as states or official territories. A northern or central line would face severe winter weather, and it would have to cross a large, wild area called Nebraska. Nebraska was neither a state nor a territory. As a result, it did not yet have a local government that could support a railroad. In addition, many congressmen did not want Nebraska to develop a government. The reason, once again, was slavery. Michael Holt says members of President Pierce's party hoped the effort to organize Nebraska would unite Democrats once again. Instead, Mr. Holt says the Nebraska Territory caused more conflicts and ruined Pierce's administration. The bill increased divisions between Democrats and Whigs and between pro-slavery activists and anti-slavery abolitionists, and it brought the country one step closer to civil war. As one Northerner wrote, it was said hundreds of years ago that a house divided against itself cannot stand. The truth of this saying is written on every page in history. It is likely that the history of our own country may offer fresh examples to teach this truth to future ages.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.